All right, everybody, welcome back. This is episode number 14, Folk and Funky Podcast. We have myself, Umran, Simran here, back after taking a break from the last episode. But today's episode is going to be very special. It's going to be very different from what we've done in the past because we have a very unique perspective and somebody that has a story unlike anybody else that we've had on this podcast before. So we are very, very excited for this super special guest. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome DJ Vani to Folk and Funky.
Thank you so much for having me. So excited we were able to make this happen, finally.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, man. Well, how's it been back in the Bay for you?
It's good. So I just moved to LA a couple months ago, but I was living in the Bay the last like 2 years in Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. But every time I come back to the Bay, it's such a treat to like reconnect with my friends and I'm here for a gig. So it's been exciting.
You're doing like a gig tonight, right?
Yeah. I'm here for a 3-day music festival hosted by DJ Habibeats.
Okay.
He's a Palestinian DJ. And so he programmed 3 full days of programming. So I'm tonight. Yeah.
Awesome. That's dope, man. Yeah. So the first question we always ask everybody, right, is like, give us a little snippet of kind of your background. Like, where did your passion for music and your other passion, which you can share with the guests or with the audience, where did all that originate from? You know, like, what's your story?
My name is Vani, and I am a neuroscientist and DJ from LA. So to take it all the way back, I am from Irvine, California in Orange County. So I grew up in Southern California where being brown was super chill and I was always like encouraged to pursue multiple interests. Like I feel like the like state of education in California is super encouraging of having multiple interests. And so I was always in the arts. Like I was always doing singing, piano, a cappella, choir, musical theater, all of the above. And then when I went to college, I started DJing. And so I feel like my whole kind of like trajectory of doing music my whole life is what led me to DJing. But I started with college radio. So I had a radio show and it was a hip hop show. And I had a 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. slot because that allowed me to play explicit music. So I would play hip hop and
we love that.
Sick. Yeah, no, that's, for real. Like, I feel like clean music on the radio is kind of boring, but apparently after 10 p.m., you can actually play explicit stuff, which is really cool.
I had no idea.
Sick. That's pretty sick.
The FCC allows that.
Yeah.
Wow. And I have some fun stories about radio as well. But then I joined a DJ collective and I started DJing on campus. And so I've been DJing for 7 years now. So I was actually ahead of the wave of DJing becoming super mainstream because I actually pursued it as like an art form that just emerged really naturally. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like trendy at the time yet. Yeah. And it wasn't very heard of to see they see female DJs at all.
Yeah.
And then I've lived in 3 different cities since then, since college. So I've lived in LA, San Francisco, and Mumbai. And in each of those 3 cities, I took DJing professionally. And so I've kind of had this like experience of trying to build my DJ network and like really perform in the three different cities that I've lived in. And so that's kind of like the arc of my DJ career so far.
Yeah. Like when you just throw like Mumbai in, I mean, that's straight up like catcher. You want like how did that like was that like during your college years or was that just like a random like just gonna go to Mumbai because it's like,
yeah. So right after I graduated college, I got a research scholarship to work in a neuroscience lab in Mumbai. Mm-hmm. So after COVID, for all of 2022, I was in Mumbai for a year working in a neuroscience lab, but I also used it as an opportunity to DJ and to explore the local music scene. And it was like the sickest year of my entire life because I actually didn't visit India that much growing up. I have family in Chandigarh, I have family in Delhi, and then a little bit of family in Bombay. But I went to Bombay as an adult, just like there for a job and there to kind of live by myself. It wasn't tied to family. Mm. Like I used it as an opportunity to visit my family, but I was there as a grown adult, which was like a really exciting experience. Different so yeah, college. I was there for a full year.
That's,
it was awesome.
That's dope. Cause yeah, I mean like Mumbai is like, I mean, that's where like the scene is, right?
Yeah.
In India. So you're doing I saw like a reel once of yours, like you're mm-hmm. like a, I think like somewhere in you're in DC or something maybe mm-hmm. or in Virginia and mm-hmm. you were like DJing at night, and then you're like doing like conference in the day, and I'm like, damn, that's like just wild.
Literally, yeah, that's kind of my story. Is like I have this like really robust day job. Like it's a really, really kind of very busy day job of working in a neuroscience lab and doing research, and then DJing kind of slots in really nicely in the evening, you know, because it's like it only really happens in the evening, and so it's a difficult balance to kind of manage it all, but it's really fulfilling, and I feel like I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing right now.
That's dope. Like we got introduced to you, the first time we saw you was in Sacramento, and you were performing for Raghinder. Shout out to Raghinder.
Hey, shout out Raghinder, for real.
So how did you get connected with him? Because you've opened for him on multiple occasions as well, right? So how did that connection kind of come to be?
I actually met Raghinder in Mumbai. So he was there during a couple months.
That time you were...
Yeah, 2022, at very end of 2022. Because he comes to India periodically for music stuff. I think he like he did Coke Studio Bharat.
He does actually come quite a bit.
He's doing some awesome like collaborations with folks, especially Punjabi folks. And so... we met like, I think just at a club called Car Social in Bombay, where they have this Thursday night party called Dance Okay Please. And so a lot of people, especially like industry folks, will go to that every Thursday because they know it's like a solid night of dance music. And so I met Raghinder through some mutual friends and we hung out a couple times, and then we were like, you know, there's definitely a musical like connection here. We should definitely work together. And so I've now opened for him twice. I opened once for his project Mastane with Asad Khan, and then I opened for his solo show with Supreme Sidhu
I mean, like sick.
That's sick.
Connect like that. Your opening show. That's fucking badass.
Yeah. It was crazy. And Supreme Sidhu's so good live.
I know,
like
man.
Huge shout out.
I was at that show. That was so oh my God. Dope.
Yeah, it was in Oakland.
In Oakland. Putting on for the Bay, that was so dope that like everybody showed up for that. It was really cool to see.
And for some reason I couldn't, like, you know, from the stage you can like kind of see the crowd. Mm-hmm. For some reason I could only see like a couple aunties, my dad, like, and then a couple girlies in the front. So like I felt very encouraged that day, because like I had this like one auntie, it's like Raghinder's childhood friend's mom, and she was like dancing the whole time to my set. It was like, this is the energy I need to keep going.
I think I saw like a video, you said like your parents come out to your gigs.
Yeah. My parents are super supportive of DJing stuff, so they actually often come to my shows. Especially that one, like Raghinder's such an incredible musician that both my parents love his music. So it's like the perfect,
it hits all like
haters to everybody. For sure.
Exactly. That was like the perfect event for them to come to, because he was doing live instrumentation, I was DJing, Supreme Sidhu was singing. Like it was so fire.
Awesome.
It's like an all ages event too.
It caters to everybody. You've had a lot of opportunities internationally to DJ as well, right? Like you did a tour in India a couple years ago, I think. Like how did those opportunities come about? And like another thing I wanted to ask you is like, how validating is it for you to be noticed on like a global scale as opposed to like just in California?
Totally. So for context, I would say in the last 5 years, the music scene in India has radically transformed. Because I feel like pre-COVID, let's say like COVID is one of our benchmarks. Pre-COVID, the entire scene was dominated by Bollywood, where like Bollywood was the only type of music getting exported out of India. And it's incredible. I mean, it's like a cultural, it's such a cultural staple. But I think in the last like 5 years, we've seen in like a lot more money and a lot of energy going towards independent artists in India. So for example, there's a lot of singer-songwriters that are on the come up, but there's also a lot of DJs and electronic music and world music that's really like really, really being appreciated and funded and marketed in India now. And so when I went in 2022, it was like an amazing time because there was a lot of like high quality events going on, a lot of international folks starting to come to India to perform, you know, like even like the Ed Sheerans and all these like fun collaborations we're seeing happening between the West and India. Like some of these things are new because there's a lot more energy in the music scene. So 2022 was a great time to live in Mumbai because I got connected to a lot of other DJs and a lot of up and coming artists. And so then I went back in 2024 and I did an India tour because I had made all those connections, grown my career in the US, and then I went back to India and I had enough
when you're there, what time of the year are you there? Is this like a summer thing or is it like a
so summer is monsoon season, so nightlife is a little bit
yeah, I can see.
He lived in India for like 10 years.
Oh wow. Where?
I lived in Punjab.
In Punjab. Yeah. Where specifically?
I lived 30 minutes out of Chandigarh for a bit. Okay. Yeah.
I love Chandigarh.
I know that because I think I remember seeing, again, I saw him like popping up on the feed. Like doing a gig. Did you do a gig in Chandigarh?
Dude, I haven't done a gig in Chandigarh yet. I really want to.
Maybe you mentioned you were from Chandigarh. Maybe.
Yeah. That's what I have a lot of really, really close family there.
Because Chandigarh supposedly has like a scene now of like DJs or I don't know.
Really?
Something I heard is like DJs come out to Chandigarh now.
Yeah. No, so, people pull up. They definitely pull up to Chandigarh. Yeah. I don't know about the local scene yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know. I know like Mumbai, that is like definitely the scene.
That's
I don't know.
The spot.
Is Diddley the scene too?
Yeah. Diddley's popping, like actually popping. So I started getting connected to a lot of like local artists. Oh, so I did my India tour in winter.
Yeah.
Winter is the like season. Nightlife season. Because there's a lot of music festivals that also happen.
They have a Goa festival, right?
Yeah, there's a festival in Goa. There's an amazing festival called Echoes of Earth in Bangalore, which is like where they take over the forest. And they put lights and stages and big art pieces and electronic music and jazz in Bangalore. That's called Echoes of the Earth.
That's
then
wild.
There's also this music festival in Rajasthan where they take over a palace in a Rajasthani palace.
Wow.
I'm blanking on the name of the festival.
You were at these festivals or these are just festivals?
So I guess what I was saying is that nightlife season where like things really, really pop off is winter.
Hmm.
So like all these festivals are in December, January, November. Like I feel like that's the time.
Yeah.
So that was the perfect time to do my tour because basically the way that I structured it is I just like using my network and using DJs that I'm a big fan of, I hopped on a bunch of shows in different cities and basically like accrued enough of a budget to kind of like fund my travel. I couldn't fund my travel to India and back, but my local travel and my accommodations and stuff, I was able to cover with the money I was making from my shows. And so I got to do some awesome shows like Soho House, Mumbai. I did a show in Bangalore. I did a show in Delhi and then in Goa at this new venue called Juna in Goa. And I feel like it was a really, to your point about like international validation, I feel like it really like gave me a stamp on my career that like, oh, I can do this. And I'm like,
100%.
I'm self-managed and I'm my own agent in this case. You know what I mean? And so it's purely from pitching myself through cold emails or like leveraging my network that I was able to like organize this tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a DJ, like you can do a low production, like a pretty low production tour. Cause like, I'm just pulling up with my USB and plugging in, which is so nice.
Yeah.
And my brother came with me. So my brother actually came with me and helped handle some of my other operations and also did content stuff for me. So we have a beautiful vlog where he captured us going through India together and also my sets and everything. So it was like such a fun experience.
That's dope. Did you notice any difference in like the vibes of the crowd? Like overseas, not just in India, but like you performed like Tokyo, right? Versus like in the States.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's a great question. Cause I think like DJing in dynamic spaces is kind of like an experience that every DJ goes through, right? Where like every place you go is different. And so you kind of have to strike this balance between bringing your own energy where like, I know I have a sound, like my sound as a DJ is really distinct, but at the same time, I want to like play for the people that are there.
Right,
and I want to like, you know, like adapt to the environment that I'm in. And so even in the US, like different cities have different vibes, different cultural spaces have different vibes. Like I sometimes play Afrobeats parties or I play Latin parties, but you know, I'll drop a Punjabi track
or
two and it goes the hardest.
Yeah.
And so I think as a DJ, you have to strike this balance between what's for, like, what are you doing for yourself versus what are you doing for the crowd?
Mm-hmm.
So I would say in India, the crowds are really interesting because there's like, there are two different types of spaces. One where like they only want to hear Indian music and then other spaces where they don't want to hear
they don't
Indian
want it at
not
all.
At all. They're like, we get this at home. We got this growing up. Like give us some Afro, some Latin.
I remember like some of the clubs out there, they do not play any brown music. It's all like just house music.
Yeah, no, literally. And so you have to know which space you're entering into. Cause like, sometimes it's too saturated and then they're like, even if it's an Afro Desi flip of a Bollywood song, they're like, we still don't want to hear it. But then other times, like, depends on who you're playing for. But then obviously like there are some spaces where all they want to hear is all they respond to is Bollywood. And then what's funny about Bollywood is like also everyone has the dance moves to go along with it. And so it does make it extra fun to play like for a Bollywood crowd because like there's choreography for every song. People go crazy.
Yeah, for sure.
That's wild.
Yeah.
So how, like you're saying you're playing in Tokyo. like what was that vibe like? Like, is it like Afro like vibes, or is it like a
EDM,
like Bollywood?
Maybe.
Like what?
Yeah. Bollywood. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Tokyo was an exciting one for sure. So my mom had a business trip in Tokyo, and it happened to align with a week that I could take off of work. And so I was like, yo, like I'm going to go to Tokyo with my mom, you know? And so, okay. So then I was like, I want to DJ so badly in Tokyo. How do I make that happen? And so I started sending pitch emails in English.
Shit.
To different kind of like, whether it was, I tried everything. I tried brands, I tried clubs, I tried radio stations, I tried other DJs, and I didn't get a single response. And I was like, okay, that didn't work. So then I started Google translating my emails to Japanese.
Oh, wow. I was going to say, it's like some AI jumping up in here. Yeah, okay.
And so I started sending my pitch emails in Japanese. Okay. Still wasn't really getting any responses. Yeah. And like, I get it. Like, I feel like one of the things about DJing is that the ideal scenario is that you have a relationship with the community or with the party or with the DJ before you start pitching yourself for a gig. But I was kind of like, I'm only coming for a week. I'm going to really try my best. I only got one response, and it was from this vinyl shop called Jazzy Sport Tokyo. And they were having a market where they were having a pop-up with a bunch of like brands in the area, so like fashion brands and lifestyle brands, and then they had a pop-up for Jazzy Sport, and they were like, they sent me this email, in very cryptic email in Japanese, where they were like, okay, you can come DJ, but if we don't like what you're playing, please stop.
Oh, wow.
The pressure is on.
Translation.
Like, you better be good.
Wow. I was like, that's so valid. Yeah. Like, let me shut the fuck up. You know what I mean? And so, okay, so when I went, I feel like I was like, okay, time to do some research on the local scene. So coming into that set, I started doing research on Japanese electronic music and local music. And I also have some other Japanese faves. Like, there's this Japanese R&B artist called Umi. It's like, I knew I wanted to play her stuff. But then when I got there, I started by playing some R&B and funk. And when people heard Thundercat, and they were hearing like SmiNo and like some like really like funky but new age R&B stuff, everyone was responding so well to that. And then I threw in some Afro beats. Mm-hmm. And that was super exciting, because like, I had someone come up to me and be like, and mind you, like, we sometimes would pull up our phone and just use Google Translate.
Like, just to talk to
each other. Most people don't speak English, and they're very adamant on kind of like sticking to Japanese, but they're also quick to pull out their phone for Google Translate so you can communicate easily. And so when I explained that, like, I was playing Rema, this Afrobeats artist from Nigeria, it was really exciting to people. You know what I mean? Like,
that's it.
And so, yeah. So I think, like, again, it's like this balance of bringing my own sound. I know this is what I like to play, but also like doing my research on the community and the environment I'm going into.
That's so sick that you were able to catch that vibe, man. That must have been a little intimidating for you, you know, like, especially with the email, like, a little bit of pressure.
Yeah,
they were so welcoming though, like so welcoming. Hospital. The whole team at Jazzy Sport like took me out to dinner afterwards and bought me drinks the whole night. Awesome. Like, it was so fun. They were so welcoming. Yeah, it was such a treat. And I get it. Like, I get why you could be skeptical of a cold email. I mean, that's very valid.
That's a freaking experience right there. That's
totally
a wild story.
Yeah. That's really awesome.
I want to lean into your other, like the other side of your life that you spend a lot of time in, your other passion.
Yeah.
Tell us about neuroscience. Tell us about how you got into that. And it's so dope that you've been able to find like harmony between these two things and kind of work them both into your life. So totally. Like, how did that, what's the story behind that?
Thank you so much. Yeah. So I went into college undeclared. I actually like applied undeclared, which is a crazy thing to do in retrospect. But I think it matched up with where I was at, where I had a lot of interest, but I just didn't know what I really wanted to sink my teeth into. So I went to a liberal arts college where I kind of got to do a wide range of subjects. And that's like a part of the curriculum, which worked out really well for me. But I still kind of like tried to pursue science. I thought science might be interesting to me. I like was pre-med for one semester and I was like, nope, not that. Oh,
gotta do it for the dizzy,
for the parents.
Yeah, I had to try it and I was like, no, not for me.
It's good that you figured it out early.
I did organic chemistry. I was like, that's enough for me. But then I did discover neuroscience, where neuroscience is like a really fascinating combination of hard science and social science. You know, it's like there's a lot of collaboration between psychology and neuroscience, obviously. Yeah. And so I was like, oh my God, this aligns with my interests because I'm so nosy. I've always wanted to know what's going on inside everyone's head all the time. And so finding neuroscience, I was like, oh, like the fact that it's also a very multi and interdisciplinary field where you can do the neuroscience of anything. So my first internship was on the neuroscience of like criminals, like basically trying to like use neuroscience data in court cases as a way of kind of explaining, not explaining someone's behavior, but giving more context on the state of mind they might've been in when they did the crime by identifying regions of their brain that like are impaired, like especially like your decision-making centers. So that was my first internship and I was like, this is crazy. Like neuroscience feels like it's at the forefront of science in a lot of ways. And now that the AI boom and like boom is happening, you're like, oh, I see how intelligence and neuroscience are kind of at the forefront. But then my second internship, I did the neuroscience of music. And I was like, oh shoot. Like
that's your vibes.
That's my vibe. That's this could be my lane. And so since like sophomore year of college, so since 2018.
Were you DJing before this or was it still?
I was just discovering DJing that year as well. So like both of those things kind of emerged separately. And then together. But like I said, I've always had this like interest in music. So that was already kind of strong. And so that summer I did, I worked in a lab that was looking at the neuroscience of musical improvisation. And when I got to the lab, they were like, hey, you can pitch a musician that you might want to study. Because they were basically going to do a series of case studies on musical improvisers. Because they were like, basically, improvisation is a really hard skill to measure in science because very few people can even do it. It's like a very elusive skill that takes a lot of training. And so they were like, you know, I think the best way to study this is to just look at master improvisers and do a study where you don't have to compare them to anyone else. It's just looking at them and what's happening in their brain while they're improvising. And so I pitched Ustad Zakir Hussain because I was like, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of a master improviser? It's going to be tabla maestro Ustad Zakir Hussain. He lives in the Bay Area.
He lived in the Bay Area.
Rest in peace, a legend. But he lived in Marin. And my PI actually had some sort of connection to him because he's kind of been in the like music, the global music space where he like does some, like does a lot of like international outreach talking about like Indian classical music. So people have heard of him. A lot of people have heard of him, even Western
especially
folks.
In the Bay. Definitely.
Especially in the Bay. He also has done a lot of jazz collaborations, things like that. And so it was actually crazy because he happened to be performing in the Bay at SF Jazz, at San Francisco Jazz, a couple weeks later. So my professor that I was working with was like, I mean, okay, like, why don't you go to his concert? And then maybe you could go to the green room after and just ask him if he wants to participate in our study.
That's so cool.
And I was like, what? I was like, respectfully, what do you mean?
Yeah.
And he was like, just go knock on his green room door and say you're here to ask him about doing a musical improvisation study. So I went to the concert and I was like sitting in the audience, like analyzing. I was like, oh my God, like he's improvising. What do I want to ask him? And then he's so generous. He came out to the lobby after the concert and met all of his fans. And so he like stayed for 30 minutes talking to all of his fans. I didn't have to actually knock on his green room door, but my PI was like, you could just go do that and say you're with me. I was like, bet.
Yeah.
So Zakirji was so generous. He was talking to all of his fans in the audience. And so I did actually go up to him. And I think he had a little bit of context on this work. And so he was like, oh my gosh, I would love to, love to participate in this study.
Yeah.
It's actually really sweet to think back on how this progressed. Because I've talked about this study a lot in my life, but the origin is actually very sweet because it really came from his own enthusiasm and willingness to participate. Because that whole summer, we actually collaborated with him to design the experiment, where basically we were going to have him improvise in an MRI scanner to be able to see live in his brain what's happening while he's improvising.
Wow.
But the thing
is, how does that work? Like using an MRI scanner and
So basically, what the way that they've done these studies in the past is they have the participant lie in the MRI.
Yeah, I was gonna say, how does that work for a double up player?
So they're like lying back, and then the studies that they'd done before, they'd done mostly on piano playing, and so what they would do is they would rest a MIDI keyboard on their lap and have the participant try to stay extremely still and just play the keys and improvise on the on this keyboard, and then you can see what's happening in the brain while they're improvising. Mm-hmm. We had a unique challenge because we wanted to study a drummer.
Yeah.
And we really wanted to have him drum. So we used his local tabla maker, I think actually his Indian tabla maker from India, to make a non-ferromagnetic tabla. So that's, it's really simple. It was just the wooden tabla drum. There's two, there's one that's metal, one that's wooden. Yeah. We took the wooden one and we just made sure there was no metal in it. So like the circle at the top tends to have iron filaments. So he just made it without that, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so he was able to take the drum into the scanner. So we had one tabla. And again, he just basically balanced it on his lap and played the tabla in the scanner. So he would like basically try to keep the rest of his body really still, and he just moved his hands, and you can kind of like correct for that when you're analyzing the brain data later. Mm-hmm. So he played and he improvised live in the scanner, and he kind of like helped us design the experiment. So we did like a improv versus memory. So what happens when he's improvising versus when he's playing something that he already knows that that's really easy for him to play. Mm-hmm. And so we
and you can see all that in the scanner.
So you can basically see the difference between the improv condition where he's improvising versus the memorization condition. And so whatever is common between the two, like whatever brain correlates are common, where like obviously like there's motor activity from him playing and things like that, you remove all of that just to see what the difference is between memorization and improvisation to kind of get at what's unique to improvisation.
So it's not like a live thing. You're seeing like something jumping around on like the brain, or it is?
No, so great question. So with MRI, you're basically averaging over time and you're looking at where in the brain it's activated. So MRI is used to identify spatial regions, like where in the brain something is happening. And then there are other ways to look at time. So if you wanted to see like over the course of his improvisation, what's happening in his brain, you would use a different method. But for MRI, you can see where in the brain is lighting up when he's improvising.
That's wild.
Do you want a sneak peek of the results?
Yeah, I was going to ask you like, what was the outcome? Like, what did you guys learn from
it? Okay. So what's really fascinating about the neuroscience of musical improvisation, and this is like a consistent finding that's been looked at over multiple improvisers, mm-hmm. like lots of different group studies have shown this, is that so the prefrontal cortex, the like very front of your brain, is what's really involved in decision-making and logic and analysis. And that part of the brain is deactivated during improvisation, which means that when you're really in a flow state and you're actually improvising, you can't be like in real time calculating, okay, what do I want to play next? Like, you know, like whether you're playing piano or you're playing drums, you can't like calculate what your next, what you're going to play next. You have to kind of like lean into a more intuitive state of mind, let your body take over, let your muscle memory take over. And so that's kind of what we find, is this the deactivation of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, indicating that the flow state is a more intuitive state of mind. Just super fascinating, super interesting.
That's wild.
Yeah.
That's so I mean, I had a ton of questions about
so just dope.
Like neuroscience part of it.
Just like, so excited to talk about that.
Just, like, man, just seeing Zakir Hussain, like, freaking, like, whatever, playing his tabla in an MRI scanner, like, bro, that's just a vibe right there.
I know.
That's
crazy. So interesting. Yeah. And he's such a sweet. He was, sorry, I don't want to speak about him in the past tense because his legacy will live on forever, you know.
Legend.
He's still with us because his presence comes through in so many different ways, through his music, through his interviews, everything.
So you're right now, you're getting your PhD.
Mm-hmm.
What is like your, like, you probably have like a thesis or like something you're like working on?
So I'm at USC in the Brain and Creativity Institute, which I'm so grateful to be in. I feel like that's like, that was a perfect place for me to be. And LA is such an exciting place to be because it's also a place where I can grow my music career, my DJ career, which is amazing as well. And that was a big goal of mine.
It's home, so, right? It's home,
yes, and it's also home. So I'm also near my family, near my parents, near my friends. Yeah. Like, so lucky. So right now we're looking at how music training affects the brain. So it's like any form of training. It's basically like when someone decides to like learn a musical instrument or even participate in a choir or a drum circle, but some sort of like consistent musical activity, how does that change the brain? And so we're looking at that in kids. Like, so for example, like kids who have never had any music experience.
He just started singing lessons.
Oh my God. So, we have to test your brain.
Yeah, we have to test Audrey's brain.
We have to see what happens. Yeah, for real. So we're looking at it in kids, trying to see like, if a kid has never had any music training, how does, you know, a year of consistent music training change their brain? Mm-hmm. And for kids, it can make a huge difference in terms of like their executive functioning, their attention, kind of even like their ability to like do fine motor control of their fingers. You can kind of imagine that music training is a really unique sort of education that kind of is part of the whole body, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Then we're also looking at it in older adults. And so that's how music training can be used as a therapy. Mm-hmm. So it's like kind of looking into like for older adults who haven't been practicing music, how does trying to learn something new at that stage of their life, how can it be used to improve their social, emotional well-being?
Yeah.
It could even help with like motor control, mm-hmm. you know, like some older adults who might not have full control of their motor skills, like it could be used to kind of work on their motor skills. And then even like just the group dynamic, like the social aspect of doing something like a choir or a drum circle can also be really transformative for older adults. Yeah. A hearing loss, it's another thing like where like doing an instrument and like doing music stuff can help with their hearing loss. There's all kinds of ways that music can affect the brain.
Like the question, one of the questions I had was like how like somebody who is like a novice and mm-hmm. someone who's a pro, would they have like, you know, the same brain activity, or is it like a, I don't know, different? Or I mean, I know like motor skills would obviously be different, but are they like, yeah.
No, such a good question. Yeah, I think yes, there is significantly different brain activity in a novice versus a pro. So that's why like continuing to practice is a really key aspect of maintaining your musical skill, is that you kind of, you know, use it or lose it. It's like one way we talk about things with the brain is like, your brain fundamentally changes. So it can become like the synapses between different regions can become stronger the more that you practice. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a pro musician's brain might actually be more connected in certain areas than a novice's brain. But the idea that we kind of want to promote is that across the lifespan, you can keep learning. Mm-hmm. And so these kinds of brain changes can happen at any stage of life. And at any age that you are, you can still be positively impacted by learning something new.
That's
and
awesome.
So that's like a really exciting finding, is that even when you're an older adult, your brain can still change. Your brain can still be plastic and can still learn new things.
I could say to add to what you're
saying.
Yeah. Producer director.
Chiming in.
As I'm an adult learning how to sing. When I first took my lessons, I think I've been taking it for like 2.5 months now, like on a weekly basis.
Congrats.
Thank you. I could feel in my brain like it was straining and it was working mm-hmm. and things were rewiring and connecting and I was like sweating. It was a proper like workout.
Wow.
And that was like, you know, you're learning a new skill and it was entirely because I've had zero music training.
Wow.
So yeah.
What kind of singing are you doing?
Right now I'm learning Western singing.
Cool.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to, with me, it was a real struggle identifying and reproducing pitch. So that was a skill that my ears were never trained for.
Fascinating.
And so catching and then being like, this is at this level. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So there's like different fields of study looking at how pitch training, rhythm training, you know, like all these things can change the brain. But it's so exciting to see someone trying to learn something new because it's humbling in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? To learn something new after a certain point. But it's so good for the soul and for the brain.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's really important to me too, because like I work from home pretty much every day.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 9-to-5 and I just sit at my desk. Sometimes it can get really boring, really unfulfilling.
That's real.
So like like last year I bought a Thumbi and I just looked up some YouTube videos and I have it at my desk every day. And like sometimes when I'm like bored or I just like don't feel like working, I'll just like sit back and just like play the same. It's super simple, like, you know, chords like over and over again, but it just emotionally it like does so much for me, just like this little instrument just playing.
Wait, what is that again?
Thumbi is like one stringed instrument.
Oh yeah. Usually, one string.
Like best example is like Beware the Mundian de Bachke, that ding-a-ding-a-ding.
Yeah, that's gonna be, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
But I was like, oh, it's only one string, it can't be like that hard to learn. It is, by the way, but like, just like simple chords like that, like, makes such a difference emotionally. Like, just
live music, live,
that's amazing,
it's dope.
Another question, because the other
I just saw a picture. Yes, yes, yes. Got
the other time. Other time we saw you was we saw you at Bhangra and Beats Night Market.
Oh my god, that was so fun.
How did that? How did that start? Like, how did that collab start?
Dude, I went to Bhangra and Beats as a fan, like, so many times, because it's like such a. It's funny because it's such a new event, but to me it feels like an SF staple, because as long as I've been here, it's been happening. It's been, and obviously, like, those are the 2 years that it's happened, but it's like, I'm pretty sure it's only been going on for two
or three
years.
They have like nonstop Bhangra, so I don't think it's like been in the night market. They've been doing it at like a hall.
Yeah,
that's so true.
I think they had something recently.
They brought it to the city in the last couple of years, and it has blown up. Shout out to Ravi, who helps organize it.
Oh,
Ravi,
and big shout out to Ravi.
Nonstop Bhangra.
Okay, so actually how I originally got connected to them, which is funny because I'm becoming more and more tapped in with the specifically Punjabi crowd in the Bay, which is amazing. But it actually came through this DJ collective in the Bay Area that I need to give a huge shout out to, Playhouse. Playhouse is run by this girl, Tara, who does a lot of, not just South Asian programming, but it happened that like the first year or two of Playhouse, she was really putting on for like all of us emerging South Asian artists in the Bay. Mm-hmm. And what was really cool is that I have like 10 South Asian DJ friends in the Bay through Playhouse, and we're all so different. We all have so many different niches and interests. Whereas like people have like a range of interests in electronic music, world music, all kinds of things. And so Playhouse is kind of like a central hub where Tara would get a lot of different opportunities and requests, and then would kind of match it with the person that she thought it was the best fit for. And so she actually originally connected me with Bhangra and Beats, because I guess Vicky and everyone knew the folks at Nonstop Bhangra kind of had heard of Playhouse, and they were looking for someone, and she was like, okay, Vani obviously plays Punjabi music, is Punjabi, should be a good fit for this. And so I played on the main stage. It was really fun. It was really electric, because like, you're in the middle of the financial district in SF.
Yeah, it's a vibe.
Huge
vibe
crowds.
Yeah.
Like, it was so, so exciting. And then there were live performances. Like, Nonstop Bhangra did a whole performance. It was so fun. It's such a good experience.
No, they're literally doing another one next weekend.
So cool.
Yeah, I forgot to shout out GT as well. Shout out to
GT. I mentioned
Ruby, and I was like,
the guys who played Toll.
Shout out to Ashi. Ashi was our last guest.
Yeah. I saw that interview.
Yeah.
So sick.
All right, what do we got on time? We got 5 minutes left.
No,
this
has
been.
We got time. We got time. Okay, I wrote out all these questions.
Director input.
This is like a neuroscience question. But
Hit me.
I don't even know if this is like answerable, but it's like, you know, like we always have like songs that we've listened to when we're younger, right? Mm. Is there any like science behind that? Like
why nostalgia?
Why do nostalgic songs like hit harder like now? You know,
such a good question. Yeah. Okay, so music is a really interesting stimulus. Like, it's actually really interesting to study from a scientific point of view, because it's a really fascinating stimulus, where it's like an auditory stimulus, but it's a very complicated auditory stimulus, where there are so many layers to the music, where it's not just one layer of music. Like, we hear it as one layer of music, as one stream of audio, let's say. But it's like, you know, a producer might have 70 tracks that are making up this one song.
Definitely.
And so it makes it a complicated stimulus to study. But also, it activates like every part of the brain one way or the other. And so the way that we study music is like, there's just like your fundamental auditory response, which is that your brain is registering the music, but then it can activate, let's say, your reward centers. So, right, like certain music will make you feel like it's a reward. It's a treat to get to listen to.
Yeah.
And so your reward centers are activated, and then you're kind of like, memory centers are also really activated. So your hippocampus is like one hub for memory. Mm-hmm. And so music is one of the things that like encodes memory the strongest for a lot of folks. And it's like, there's actually really interesting research on Alzheimer's patients who might not remember the name of their kids, but can remember this song that they grew up on sing it from scratch and sing it completely verbatim, just because it's encoded in their memory, in their long-term memory. So music is fascinating because it can kind
retrieve. That is crazy. Yeah. Just didn't think about. Yeah.
Yeah. Retrieve some of these old memories and is encoded in a really complicated way in the brain such that it can override, even if the rest of your memory isn't working, your music memory might still be working for things that you feel nostalgic for.
Yeah. And I feel like we have memories connected to certain songs. Like one memory that I'll never forget is like being like 4 or 5 years old in my living room and like listening to Tera Yaar Bolda by Surjit Pendrakia, also a late legend. And my sisters, I have two older sisters, they would like dress me up in like a chunni and they would like have me like dance around. So I didn't know what I was doing. I was just dancing around. That song, probably if I had to pick one song that's like my favorite, it's probably the one.
Wow.
That's probably why, like, I mean, in like one of your videos, you mentioned that song, Oh Ho Ho.
Yeah.
That's
why
it hits, because it's like,
Marla hits so hard.
Yeah.
That same feeling. Also just like uniquely an.
It's a unique song.
It's a dope song.
Like, so yeah. It's such an energizing song.
The guy himself is like a vibe for his time to be dropping songs. Yeah.
Totally.
What about like sad songs? Like sometimes we all feel sad and we'll play sad music to kind of like almost indulge that sadness a little bit to like maybe give ourselves some validation. Like why do we do that? If you can answer that.
Actually, it's funny because on a personal note, one of my running jokes is, you will not catch me listening to sad music when I'm sad. I'll be sad as fuck listening to like bass music. like I'm like, I'm gonna headbang through the pain.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think the point of like kind of like indulging the emotions or even outsourcing the emotions, where sometimes you like understand your own feelings better from hearing someone else sing about it, or hear it, like hearing it musically represented in a way just like allows you to like feel it in a different way than through your own lived experience. I think that's a really powerful phenomenon. I had another example. I think like also it can, I think people do kind of like spiral further from listening to sad music. That's kind of my experience where I'm like, I'm already
definitely
sad.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make myself more sad. It's always funny. Like sometimes you'll be in a car with friends and like somebody will have their shuffle on and like you're going to a function, you're getting excited, and then like Marvin's Room by Drake will come on and be like, we're not trying to simp right now. We're like play the next one.
What I'm like interested and also concerned about is the potential for AI music to like be made specifically to like target emotions. I don't know if AI, I can't really grasp what potential AI has to actually like encapsulate human emotions. I think it would just be replicating other people who have actually represented human emotions in music. But I think
AI music scares the shit out of me.
It's really freaky.
Like I mean, you're losing that human interaction, you know. It's just the computer vibes. Like,
do you think they could use that for like therapy though, like to help for the depression or whatever, like make AI music? But I feel like you could just use regular music for that too.
Yeah, I'm still trying to understand how music at specific frequencies can be used as a therapy.
Yeah.
Like I've heard of like 432 hertz, I think
I've heard of that. Yeah,
it's yeah, like being a, like
it's
a
good soothing for the brain,
something like that. Yeah, so I actually, I'll admit, I don't know how that works.
I've heard of,
There's also, you know, this like emerging market of psychedelics and how like psychedelics can be used as a therapy, but then psychedelics and music together. But I think in the creative domain, AI will never, should never, will never replace human creativity. I'm not actually even that concerned about it.
Do you use any type of AI in your DJ?
I use it for coding, like for and data analysis and stuff like that. Cause it's like,
man, you code too?
No, I don't. I literally don't.
She does it all.
I don't know how to
code.
It all. Yeah. That's why I need AI tools to run my very simple R statistics.
Okay. I feel like as long as we have artists like yourself and the guests that we've had, AI is never going to overtake that, because the human element, you can always tell like when it's made by a person.
There's some videos I saw on Instagram where like there was a some like producer used like he pulled like AI to like make a song and it sounded decent, and I wouldn't, like, nobody would have been able to like figure it out.
I
think the scary part of
that's what makes it scary.
I think like so far I'm willing to use AI just to make my life more efficient, you know? So even I don't use it in my DJing at all, but if I were, it would just be to like organize my music better and quicker and like
so like nothing for your sets, like you're not going to be playing any AI music.
No.
I thought maybe like there was maybe something AI.
You can't
there
do
was
that. Some,
something like AI has made some way into the DJ space. Maybe
honestly, like not really, because also I like to do blends that AI wouldn't predict. Like it's more fun to blend music together that shouldn't be blended together. Like I think that's the real like progress that we're making as DJs is like, oh my god, like who would have ever thought to mix this bass house with this belly dancing song? Like that's like one unexpected mix I have on my Instagram, because I'm like, yo, that shit was hard, and like that was an improvised from me, you know. And so I think like when it comes to innovation, I think that's still going to be the human creativity that's going to be at the forefront.
I mean,
of
AI
innovation
is human innovation, right? So
that is so also true. That's so, also true. Yeah. It's just trying to keep up.
I want to make sure we give you the time and the platform to talk about your parties, right? You've done Bay versus LA. Talk to us about that. And, you know, is that something you want to continue to do?
Totally. Well, thank you. So as far as like tapping in with me, I would say like coming to see me live is really
highly recommended.
Yeah.
Essential. I feel like for all the work I'm trying to do on social media, it's all just trying to funnel people to my live events, because I think fundamentally I'm a live act. Mm-hmm. And so I did curate this party, the Bay versus LA. It was a DJ competition featuring mostly my homies, but DJ homies from LA and the Bay, and that was really exciting. I did two versions of it, one in LA and one in SF. Mm-hmm. And it was a really exciting way to like showcase my DJ homies and also showcase the range of sounds within California. It was like not just a South Asian lineup, but it was a lot of South Asian folks on the lineup, and so it was also showing our own musical diversity where we were all playing such different stuff, and that was really exciting. And then also putting our creativity to the test by framing it as a competition. I would love to keep doing that. I have a bunch of ideas for how to take that spirit. I think it's like a hard party concept to scale, because in order to get I want to do the Bay versus New York, but like I got to get a bunch of DJs in a room for that.
Yeah,
but I think in the meantime, I have a lot of ideas for how to like do little DJ competitions. Like I kind of want to have DJs like swap USBs or like, I have like different ideas. Yeah. But I do want to start my own party sometime soon. I think I see that on the forefront for 2026.
That's what I want to see is like DJs
like
you guys hold your own parties.
Yes.
You're not just like going to someone else's party. I mean, Habibi Beats is definitely a DJ, right?
He started his party Habibi's House. And what's incredible about starting your own party is that you start your own community space in the process. And that's really powerful. And that's what I want to do. And I think that's why it took me a little bit of time. Like, it's not something I did at the beginning of my DJ career, because I kind of wanted to really figure out what's my sound, what's my target demographic, what's the ethos and the mission underlying the space that I want to create. But I feel like I'm getting close to figuring that out. And then it'll be an amazing opportunity to like platform emerging DJs, take my party concept around the world, and continue to do this work of like seeing what it's like to play in different cities and different countries around the world, but also bring a unique sound to it. And I think there's a space in the South Asian market. I don't think it'll be an explicitly South Asian party in the sense that like we frame it as like beats party. But I think anything I do is South Asian, because I'm South Asian. So there's like anything I do is South Asian. It just doesn't have to be on the nose all the time.
I mean, the one thing about music too is, right, there's really no borders in music, right?
It's the universal language.
Yeah, it kind of just like jumps through. Yeah.
I feel so strongly about that. And we're like empirically testing that with DJing. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
And it's been great.
Yeah, I think as you continue to do your live shows, you've already built a reputation for yourself and an audience and a following, and that's only going to continue to grow because you're an absolutely dope DJ in your live events. I'm like, for the last Rugen, their Supreme Sidhu show, like my friend pulled up and he brought his girlfriend, and we were like sitting at a bar before the show started, non-Punjabi, but I was like, yo, Bonnie's opening, we gotta be there for the opening. It was like I was like, you guys gotta see this DJ, like she's so dope. So
thank you. That's awesome.
You got anything more?
No, I say you try the fast five with there.
Yeah. So we usually close off with like three just like quick questions. I guess the first one would be like, is there an artist right now, Punjabi, non-Punjabi, whatever, like you've just been bumping lately, you've been really feeling lately, like somebody that you've been listening to a lot?
Okay. I want to take a moment this moment to spotlight some of the emerging Desi female artists.
Absolutely, definitely.
Specifically in LA, we have a ton of Desi female artists that are really incredible. Gayathri Krishnan, she's a Tamil Carnatic trained R&B singer. She's incredible. Akshara, also kind of Carnatic and Hindustani trained, making incredible fusion artists, incredible fusion music. Shreya Kaul is making, I think she's Punjabi, she's making some incredible like pop, Indo pop, like amazing stuff. Rehma is a Pakistani artist, also making amazing stuff. So we have like a really exciting emerging wave of Desi female artists making really definitely. Innovative music, which is really amazing. Then we also have an emerging wave of Desi female DJs. Mm-hmm. So I also want to shout out like Arini, my really, really good friend. She's a Bangladeshi DJ. Jag, her name is Neha. She goes by Jag. She's in the Bay Area. She's so fucking cool. She's doing like more like electronic music from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And so I think Desi women are on the come up. Yeah, Desi women are on the come up for sure. Yeah,
we're going to make a reel of that and plug all these people so that our audience becomes familiar.
I wish I had said it better.
No worries. Yeah.
I was like, Indo.
Yeah. We're all about championing the artists. That's why we started the podcast in the first place. Right. We believe so much in our music.
I mean, it's also, it's all about like learning, right?
Yes.
Yeah. As much as it's like fun to all to do the production, like at the end of the goal, the end is like learning about everything. So yeah.
Thank you so much for like creating this platform. I've seen a lot of your clips of your 14 episodes so far.
It's crazy. Yeah. It feels like this is sick. Like it always feels like this is like our first one, but yeah. Normally we would ask like who's like an underrated artist that you would, you know, give some more love to. I feel like you just mentioned a lot, but if there's anybody else that you want to mention, feel free.
Yeah. Dude, Raghinder.
Dude, shout out.
Yeah,
shout out Raghinder.
Yeah,
Raghinder. Every time I see him, I'm like, we got to have you on the podcast. And he's always like, I'll let you know. So whenever he's ready, we're here.
And like, people know about him, but he's still criminally
incredibly underrated.
No, yeah. Definitely.
The talent. Like,
the sickest, yeah.
You mentioned Flow State, and I know like we've all seen him live. You can tell when he's up there, he gets that look and he just closes his eyes and he's just fucking doing it. Yeah. And you're like, this guy's in his bag right now.
Yeah,
like,
he's exploring, you know, singing more.
Yeah, he dropped that
producing
song.
Producing more. Yeah. Like, and then who else is playing the violin like that? Like, I don't know a single other person that's shredding on the violin that. Like,
he plays like violin even with like in that classical rag way too, which is like just something.
He still does like pop up classical Hindustani performances all the time.
Just like in a park randomly, he'll just put it on a story, be like, "Hey, sick. I'm gonna be playing here."
And great guy.
Dope guy. We love Raghinder, man. Is there an artist? It could be him or anybody that you would like to see us have on next.
Oh, dude, you should get Melinda Touré.
I've heard of her.
She's the first female Dholi in North America. Yeah. Also an incredible DJ. Mm-hmm. So she co-founded the collective No Nuzzer, which was an incredible, like, the collective is no longer together, but it was an incredible, like, first of its kind South Asian DJ collective that was like, dude, like making incredible music, championing incredible like emerging DJs and creating a really like progressive, exciting South Asian space. Mm-hmm. And so she's the GOAT. I've heard of her and Rekha. DJ Rekha, but yeah, Melinda would have like 10-20 years of lore to drop, you know, like she's been really inspiring as like a champion for other South Asian people. Mm-hmm. So I think you should have her on the pod.
I think our other co-host who couldn't make it today, Slams, he's connected with her because he's a Dholi as well. That's how he got his start. So I think they're connected with each other.
Sick.
That would be a dope guest for sure.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Do you have any like anything that you're trying to promote, you know?
Oh yeah. Okay, so I would say
it won't be live. It won't be on like here, like in the next day or two.
I know. Yeah. No, I'm like, pull up to my show tonight. Yeah.
Our turnaround time's a little longer than that, but yeah.
But I would say like scarcity is good for the DJ business where like you're not going to catch me every month in your city. So keep an eye out for when I do come to your city because I feel like it's always a treat. But I'm going to be continuing to do live shows. Obviously, like my schedule is really busy, but I think playing live is the thing that motivates me and makes me feel any sort of purpose and mission. Mm. So catch me live. And then I have mixes on SoundCloud and YouTube. All my socials are under my name, Vani Divan. And then I've started to express myself more on Instagram and TikTok, so you could check out my short form content there. But like I said, it's all just a funnel to seeing me live. For sure. Yeah. And then catch my party in 2026, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
We good?
Yeah.
All right. Well,
this is so fun. Yeah.
Thank you again.
Thank you so much for coming.
I'm like, I have 10 questions of the same to ask you guys. I know. Back, we're, so we're going to have to flip it.
We might have to do a part two to this because this conversation was like so dope. Like too I said good. At the jump.
It
was,
I mean, you'll finish your paper and we'll hear.
Yeah. And then we can talk about
it. There will be a part two to this podcast for sure. But yeah, thank you guys so much for listening. Vani, thank you again so much.
Thank you for having me.
See you guys in the next one. Thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Peace.